Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is Leonard Colbert Appellant versus Kylene K. Hotailing Appellee. For the appellant, we have Michael Schaefer, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and for the appellee, we have Mr. Rodney Freeman, an attorney from Huron. You may proceed, Mr. Schaefer.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. I represent the defendant appellant in this case, Maynard Folberg, on this appeal from an order granting the plaintiff's motion for a new trial. This case arises out of a car accident that happened 4 miles north of Huron on Highway 37 in June of 2003. My client was proceeding west from the west to the east at an intersecting gravel road. He claims he stopped, looked, and proceeded across the highway. He claims it was raining and the rain obstructed his view of the plaintiff. He got into the middle of her lane of travel and she hit his passenger side of his vehicle. The plaintiff claims that it wasn't raining or it was just starting to sprinkle, but she saw him from some distance for some period of time. She had her cruise control on. She claims she applied her brakes, although the evidence of the photographs and everything after the fact refute that, and she collided with him. The defendant admitted that he was negligent. The court at the end of the case directed a verdict on the plaintiff's contributory negligence, and the case was submitted to the jury on the issue of proximate cause and the amount of damages, if any, sustained by the plaintiff. The plaintiff never moved for a directed verdict on the issue of proximate cause, never objected to any of the jury instructions on the issue of proximate cause, and never objected to the verdict form, which was a special verdict form. And the specific question given to the jury, question one was the defendant's negligent a proximate or legal cause of injury or damage to the plaintiff? Answer yes or no. They checked no. They were told if they answered no, to sign the verdict and return it, which is what they did. After the trial and after the judgment was entered, the plaintiff moved for a new trial under 59A subsections 5 and 6, alleging that inadequate damages were awarded on the basis of passion or prejudice, and on the sufficiency of the evidence to justify the verdict. And specifically, the plaintiff argued that at the very least, the jury should have awarded the ambulance bill to go to the hospital and the ER examination at the hospital on the day of the accident. At the hearing, Judge Erickson specifically ruled that in ruling on a new trial motion, the judge is not required to view the evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, and then proceeded to adopt the argument advanced by the plaintiff, saying, in effect, at the very least, she should have been awarded the ambulance bill and the ER examination costs. He entered a written order without specifying which particular ground, the insufficiency of the evidence or the inadequacy of the damages, and we filed the appeal. The evidence in this case, it was a short trial. The plaintiff presented two witnesses, herself and Dr. Joseph Carr, a chiropractor from Huron. And Dr. Carr was not a treating chiropractor or physician. He examined the plaintiff 2.5 years after the accident for purposes of an impairment rating at the request of Mr. Freeman. The plaintiff called no treating physicians, no emergency medical personnel. no doctors who had treated or seen the patient for any of her claimed injuries after the accident, offered none of her medical records, offered no bills, simply put in one exhibit, exhibit one, which was a summary of the bills in the amount of $7,900 and some. No evidence was presented by the plaintiff that the bills were reasonable, that they were medically necessary, or that they were approximately caused by the accident.
Didn't Carr tie that in a little bit?
Carr did not tie that in. Carr never offered any opinions about the medical treatment. Carr, and I read his citations, he cited Dr. Carr's deposition, I believe, at pages 42, 43, and 44, and I looked at that again. And essentially, Dr. Carr's, what happened was, about 2 years after the accident, the plaintiff claimed that she had neck problems, which she had never reported early on. And that was the guts of her claim, is that she had two herniated or bulging discs in her cervical spine that resulted in tingling and symptoms radiating into her fingers, primarily her little finger. And Dr. Carr's testimony in response to questions from Mr. Freeman at his deposition, which was read to the jury, essentially was, were those symptoms regarding the C, I think it was 5, 6, or 4, 5, consistent with the accident? And he said, yes. And he was also asked again about these tingling sensations on pages 42, 43, and 44 of his deposition, and he said they did nerve conduction tests, and the nerve conduction test essentially said it didn't jive. In other words, those levels of the vertebrae don't match the nerve distribution that she was complaining about. But he never offered any evidence whatsoever about any of the treatment that she was given, whether it was reasonable or medically necessary or anything. It's not in his deposition, period.
Nothing about Exhibit 1.
Nothing about Exhibit 1. It was never presented to him to render an opinion.
Now, the trial court, if I understand your recitation of the facts correctly, based the new trial on the failure to grant damages for the ambulance ride and the emergency room fees.
Right.
Is that what the second trial would simply be over, or do they get a complete new bite at the apple?
Well, I think that their position is they get a complete new bite at the apple. Now, they never even made a motion for directed verdict on those elements or issues, or on the issue of proximate cause.
Well, let me ask you about that. A procedural question. As the plaintiff, where you have the affirmative burden of carrying your claim forward, you don't have to make a directed verdict to preserve a right to appeal. It's usually defensive claims where a directed verdict is required to preserve.
I think under the rules, I think you're right, Your Honor. I think you can make a new trial motion under sufficiency of the evidence, under 59A6, I think specifically, without having presented it to the court, but usually where it arises is in a case where, you know, there's perhaps no damages awarded. I mean, and of course, none of the cases from this court say that you're guaranteed any specific amount in any case where a plaintiff brings a case. I mean, there's a number of cases. There's the Bridges case. There's the Hoosier versus Feller, both of which resulted in verdicts, either a defense verdict or a plaintiff's verdict with no damages, where there was a question on proximate cause. And in fact, in the Bridges case, this court said that the plaintiff had the burden of proof on causation and the extent of his injuries. In this case, and in Bridges, they presented the testimony of two doctors to say that his injuries were caused by the accident that related it. Now, there's nothing like that here. There's no testimony on these early medical bills. There's nothing. There's the plaintiff does have the burden of proof to present testimony. They could have easily called the medical providers, the ER doctor, the somebody. They just didn't do it.
But you know, under the under the facts as you so eloquently stated them to be, stating the positions of both parties, and this accident happens the way it does, and the impact occurs the way you described, isn't it almost a given that her becoming unconscious from this impact and going to the and being taken in an ambulance to ER immediately afterwards, isn't it almost a given that that unless there's some bias or prejudice, you know, she ought to recover at least for that much? Well, I mean, the position of the circuit court judge, and do you have and to make a motion for a directed verdict at that point, isn't that almost requiring a needless act?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, she never lost consciousness. There was no loss of consciousness. She was in her car at the scene of the accident, and the deputy sheriff came up to her and asked her if she was okay, and she says, I'm okay. She couldn't get out of the car because the doors were jammed shut. Everybody was taken to the hospital, including my client, his granddaughter. Everybody went.
Well, that's Justice Seaver's point. And
oh, you're right. You're right. She never lost consciousness. Right, right. You're right on that point.
It seems to me that, to follow up on what he's saying here, I mean, almost as a matter of law, when you have a highway speed, you know, T-bone type accident at highway speeds, it would seem to me that it's, as a matter of law, a trip to the hospital has got to be proximately caused by the accident.
Well, then why didn't he move for a directed verdict? Then why didn't he instruct the jury and not object to the instructions that says damage, you can award her damages, if any? Why is that in there? And then we let the jury do what we tell them they can do, and then we say, whoops, you can't do it. I mean, that's, you know, it seems to me that if there's some error in what that law is presented to the jury, that somebody should bring it to their attention. And so never.
Are you suggesting then that the burden on the plaintiff at the end of the evidence is to make a directed verdict motion on each piece of evidence?
No, I'm suggesting that if the plaintiff truly felt.
But normally you wouldn't parse.
No.
You wouldn't parse the ambulance and the medical doctor's bill and the x-ray, and you wouldn't do that. You wouldn't parse it out. You give it all to the jury, and then they have to decide.
Exactly. And the point is, if the plaintiff truly felt that there was no issue on causation, a directed verdict probably should have been made. But it wasn't. But the point you're making, Judge, is, you know, in the Bridges case, I mean, the court there said you still have to prove causation and damages. You know, I know that was a lower, Mr. Freeman points out it's a lower speed case, but is this court going to establish a rule of law that says after X number of miles an hour, we presume that there's damage? I mean, I don't know of any authority for that. In all the cases that we've cited from other jurisdictions say that there is no presumption that there's, I mean, where do you draw a bright line? I mean, I can get hit. I've gotten rear-ended by somebody going 55 miles an hour and didn't get hurt that bad. But, I mean, how do you know? You have to look at the facts of each case, I think.
But isn't that what you're asking us to do here, is substitute our judgment for that of the trial court?
No, I'm saying the trial court applied the wrong standard. The trial court did not look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict. And if the trial court would have looked at the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict, the trial court should have concluded, number one, there's no evidence in this record, medical or otherwise, that establishes, even what they're asking for, that those bills were proximately caused by legally, medically necessary or anything related to the accident. They still have the burden of proof. Maybe they could have done it, but they didn't do it. And the court doesn't have, I mean, in all of the cases, the credibility determination is purely a jury question. And this case was tried on the, essentially on the claim that these herniated or bulging discs were related to the accident. And the plaintiff was severely impeached on that because her prior medical records, chiropractic records, show that she had, years before the accident, the same exact symptoms. Those records were never given to Dr. Carr. He never had the benefit of those when he offered those opinions. So it's similar to Bridges and the other cases of this court where the testimony and the credibility of the plaintiff and the experts is undermined. And the court, the trial court in this case, adopted the view that he doesn't have to view the evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. And what he cited for that proposition was the Henry versus Henry case. And that was a case where the husband and wife lawsuit over abuse, and the jury awarded zero damages and I think $50,000 in punitive damages. And the court there said, well, we don't need to view it in the light most favorable to the non-moving party because the jury was palpably mistaken as to the law that should have applied as to how to figure these damages out. That's not this case. This is a case where there were clear disputes on causation and on the damages and whether or not any of this was related to the accident. So I don't think the court can adopt a bright line rule that says if we have a highway speed accident, as a matter of law, you're entitled to something. I mean, because how can you say that? I mean, clearly, if they might have been able to sustain their motion if they would have called the medical people from the emergency room or whatever, but they didn't do it. And that's the plain and simple fact of the matter. Now, we submit that the trial court applied the wrong standard. The trial court abused its discretion. This court should reverse, remand, and ask to have the judgment reinstated. But in the alternative, we've argued that if it does go back for a new trial, that we're clearly entitled to have the issue of contributory negligence submitted to the jury. There were significant factual disputes between the two versions of the facts as to what happened and who did what. And under the case law that this court has cited in any number of cases, even a driver on a through highway that's protected by stop signs has to act with reasonable care if they see someone not stopping or stopping and coming out. They can't just ignore that. And the evidence in this case suggests that the plaintiff did that. She had her cruise control on and never, from what we can tell, ever hit the brakes because there's no evidence of any skid marks. So for all of those reasons, we would submit that the trial court should simply be reversed on the grant of the new trial, and in the alternative, if it is affirmed, that we'd be entitled to submit the contributory negligence issue to the jury. Thank you.
Mr. Shaver, did the interrogatories, request for admissions, that type of thing, was that utilized in this case? And if so, was the dispute about causation in proximate cause raised in discovery, so that everybody was aware you were disputing all the medicals as far as being reasonable in this?
But there was no request for admission or any. I don't even know if there were interrogatories. I think we just exchanged the medical records. We took the deposition of the parties and we took the deposition of Dr. Carr well in advance of trial, and it was very clear from Dr. Carr's deposition and my cross-examination of him is that we were disputing everything. And we disputed it in our answer.
But a lot of cases, it's very evident that the plaintiff knows they're going to have to prove this because the defense is disputing necessity and reasonableness of medical bills.
Yeah.
It just didn't probably happen. It was a simple enough case where that...
It was simple that... I know before trial, Mr. Freeman gave me a copy of his Exhibit 1, and I told him he couldn't put in there the cost of the IME because I didn't think that was recoverable, so he took it out and resubmitted that as Exhibit 1.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Did you put in a general denial, or was it basically you remit them to the proof thereon and so forth?
I looked at our answers, and we specifically denied that her injuries or damages were proximately caused by the negligence of the defendant. We specifically denied that in the answer.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. Mr. Freeman, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. A couple of points I'd like to clear up. In my reading of the Bridges case, I don't believe that it's solely based on the difference in the speeds that the parties were going in Bridges and in this case. Bridges was truly a minor fender bender. They didn't even report it to the police because they didn't think it amounted to over $500 in damage. In this one, Ms. Hotelling obviously was taken to the emergency room. Mr. Foberg and his granddaughter, he had broken ribs. His granddaughter, I believe, had a concussion. In Bridges, Bridges did not even go to the hospital. He continued on. He met with his realtor, and it was only later that day that he went to the hospital. And I think that's a major distinction. Secondly, when Ms. Hotelling answered the deputy sheriff who approached her car after the accident, he said, "Are you okay?" And she said, "I'm okay." And she then clarified that by saying, "I'm not dead, so I'm okay." So it's not she's simply saying she didn't have any pain or any injuries as a result of that accident. In fact, she testified at length about the pain she was in immediately after the accident when her knees were jammed up under the steering wheel up against the dash.
Was there an injury to her knees?
Yes. Yes, there was, Your Honor.
And they found that at the ER?
Well, they didn't examine that. They were most concerned with her neck and her back. They did an MRI of those areas. She had bruising. She was never really medically treated for her knees as such, but she did testify that she was in a great deal of pain at that time relative to her knees.
So that's how you got the evidence of her injuries, was through her direct testimony?
Through her direct testimony, and all of her medical reports and records were stipulated to by both counsel and admitted by the court. So the jury had the benefit of all of her medical reports, including the MRI that was done at the emergency room the day of the accident, which said the reason for that specifically was a motor vehicle accident. The final thing is as to the exhibit listing the medical bills, including the ambulance and the ER visit, were stipulated to as an exhibit by both counsel and admitted to the jury.
What were the words of the stipulation by yourself and opposing counsel as to Exhibit 1?
I believe, Your Honor, I sent it to Mr. Schaefer, and I said, "Look this over. Can we agree to stipulate to this as an exhibit?" And we made a minor adjustment, or an adjustment, wasn't so minor, I guess, but we made an adjustment to it, and then it was just mutually agreed that this was stipulated to. I can't recall, very honestly, that we ever said these are reasonable and necessary. So that wasn't, I don't believe, included as part of Mike and my stipulation to the court. It was simply, we have stipulated that these can be the exhibits, and we're not going to argue over them.
And reasonable and necessary is an element of proof on which you carry the burden.
Yes, sir.
And as I understand, Mr. Schaefer, There's no evidence of that.
Well, I believe it was never questioned at trial that it was unreasonable, that the medical or that the ER visit was not necessary, nor was it questioned that it was medically and financially irresponsible and not. So that was never an issue at trial or, to my knowledge, to the jury.
But it's an issue under the answer where he specifically denied the injuries were caused by the negligence of the defendant.
But he stipulated, Your Honor, that these were the bills. This was what was incurred by Ms. Hotelling when she was taken by ambulance. The ambulance sent her a bill for $375, and that was stipulated to that the jury could have, in essence, that bill without having to bring ambulance personnel in to talk about.
But those are just things you're adding. As I understand it, all he stipulated to was that Exhibit 1 was a list of your claimed medical bills.
That they're not the claimed medical bills, that they were the medical bills. That's what was stipulated to, that I don't need to lay a foundation and bring in every one of these medical providers to establish that that was the expense.
Was that what? Part? But, okay, see, that's the point. I mean, if it's just stipulated that this exhibit represents these places where she went and the numbers, but, see, now you're adding that it's not necessary for you to bring in a doctor, it's not necessary for you to bring in any medical personnel, it's not necessary for you, in essence then, to prove a probable cause or approximate cause or necessity or that these are fair and reasonable expenses. See, if you had that written in the stipulation, there would be no appeal, would there?
Well, there likely could still be an appeal, Your Honor. I understand what you're saying, but what we stipulated to were that these were the bills that were incurred by Ms. Hotelling. Whether or not those bills were the proximate a result and the proximate result of the automobile accident was a question for the jury. That I understand, and that I think Mr. Schieffer and I both agree. And I can certainly understand, and we wouldn't be here today if the jury had said, wait a minute, we're not buying into your neck pain. We don't think that may be something that was pre-existing. She had fallen down the steps after the accident. It could have been something that aggravated a pre-existing condition. I can certainly understand a jury saying that. But when we have stipulated that these were the bills, she didn't call the ambulance, someone else did, either a third party or law enforcement. They took her, the ambulance took her to the emergency room from the scene of the accident, and the emergency room then charged her with that. And we stipulated to that.
If you understand and agree that the rest of the damages are a jury question, then why shouldn't your new trial be limited to the ambulance ride and the ER exam?
Well, I don't believe. Well, I'm not going to tell you. I think you could certainly remand it on that issue, as opposed to a new trial starting all over. But if a jury has already shown bias and prejudice on that side of it, how can you disregard that bias and prejudice on all of the rest of it? I mean, for the jury just to say, again, I can understand a jury. I am not being critical of a jury. I believe this jury had every right in the world to judge her credibility, to judge Mr. Foberg's credibility, and to make a decision as to whether or not these were pre-existing or aggravated injuries that were given her difficulties, or whether or not she had any difficulties at all. And I understand they have every right in the world to disregard Dr. Carr's testimony, where he said she's 20% permanently impaired, which means that she is 20% less than she was before this accident. That's what Dr. Carr testified to. And in Dr. Carr's deposition, he lists all of the information that he had, that he reviewed prior to his examination. But jury's got every right to disregard that. Jury has every right to judge her credibility, her testimony, and the other witnesses.
Tell us why you think it was not necessary for you to make a motion for a directed verdict.
Because, quite honestly, Your Honor, I believed, I knew it wouldn't be granted. I'm the plaintiff in a negligence case. And while Mr. Fulberg admitted negligence, I knew from the deposition and the medical records that Mr. Schaefer was going to come at us for pre-existing and an aggravation. He made a big issue of that with the jury.
Was it ever an issue about the ambulance costs and the...
No. No, Your Honor. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'm sorry.
But that was not argued to the jury. There was no... That was not disputed that you were aware of.
No.
In any of the arguments.
No. In fact, I think everybody was dumbfounded when the jury came in. Not with a zero. Not with checking that none of it was proximate cause. Again, I've been zeroed before, and that didn't flabbergast me. But to have the jury come back and say she shouldn't even get the ambulance or the ER room?
Will you address Mr. Schaefer's argument that the judge used the wrong standard in granting a new trial?
Well,
that he took the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff as opposed to most favorable to the jury's verdict.
I think, I disagree with that, and I think I remember the oral argument on the motion, and I think, quite frankly, I think the trial court was as flabbergasted as I know I was, and I suspect Mr. Schaefer was, when the jury came back with an absolute nothing. Not even the emergency room. I think that's a standard the judge used.
Did the judge say what standard he was using?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think the judge, the best standard was, everybody's flabbergasted. How could this happen? I mean, I could see him coming back with $400 verdict.
Didn't he say something like, I can't imagine this verdict unless there was some bias or prejudice without describing what it was?
Yes, Your Honor.
What do you say about the argument that if the case is remanded that contributory negligence should be an issue?
Well, she's driving down the highway, and this is her testimony. It's very clear in the record, in her deposition and at trial. She's driving down the highway. She has her speed control on 65, which is the speed limit. She is beginning to slightly rain. She sees the defendant, or Mr. Fulberg, pulling up on the gravel road, coming onto the highway. She realizes, she knows there's a stop sign there. She travels this road every day back and forth from her home to her work. She sees Mr. Fulberg. She suddenly realizes he's not going to stop, and she slams on her brakes and veers to the right to avoid him.
How do you explain the absence of tire marks?
It was raining. I mean, while we have some photographs, Your Honor, they're not close-ups. They're not. I don't know the distance from where they were taken. They look to me personally, they look like they were pretty close to the accident scene itself and not further away. I can't explain it. But I don't believe that, if that's the only thing, which is the negative. Mr. Fulberg testified he never saw her. He said it was raining so hard he couldn't see out of his window. And true, he said he stopped at the intersection. And my client, Ms. O'Telling, said he didn't. But whether he did or didn't, I don't think negates or creates contributory negligence. He goes across, he doesn't see her. So the only testimony we have to the jury is Ms. O'Telling's testimony that she saw him, she thought he was going to stop. When she realized he wasn't going to stop, she slammed on her brakes, turned to the right, and the airbag deploys upon the hip. And Mr. Schaefer's only argument against that is a purported lack of skid marks in several pictures that were taken close to the intersection. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay,
unless
thank
there are no further questions.
No one has ever chastised for quitting earlier. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Kramer.
You.
Okay, Mr. Schaefer, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll try not to take it.
That's not a demand,
Joe. On the contributory negligence issue, you know, I mean, there's all sorts of... First of all, the plaintiff testified the pavement was dry. And there are a number of photographs from the sheriff's department right there. There's no skid marks whatsoever. She said Mr. Fulbert was coming. She saw him some distance away. He never even slowed down, she claims, and went right through. She has no explanation for why she didn't do something at all.
Do you dispute that her testimony that she tried to avoid him?
I don't dispute that she may have turned to the right, but she hit him head on in her lane of travel. The evidence is that she was heading north on Highway 37. She hit him, T-boned the passenger side of his car in her lane of travel. I think there's a fact question there.
But doesn't all that go away, though, in a case like this where you admit negligence?
No, because, no, it doesn't. I mean, I think that's what the judge thought. Because he thought, well, if I admit negligence, then contributory negligence isn't an issue. Well, that can't be true. Contributory negligence can still be an issue, and that's why the jury's entitled to listen to both versions of both parties as to what happened. Mr. Fulberg's version was he stopped and then proceeded forward. He also said, I know that I can't do that on a highway unless I can assure that I can do so safely. You know, her version was completely different, that he blew through the stop sign. You know, so he was negligent by his own standard, even if he stopped. But that doesn't mean that the jury's not entitled to consider the contributory negligence of the plaintiff. It doesn't take it out of the case. Now, on the stipulation, there was no stipulation. Mr. Freeman sent me these summary of the bills and said these are the bills that she and this is a summary of the bills that she incurred.
Let me just interrupt and come back to the contributory negligence. You're not claiming she was speeding. The only thing you're saying the contributory negligence on her part would have been that somehow she didn't stop soon enough or avoid the accident. But she wasn't speeding. She was on the highway. She had definitely the right of way.
But
what is it that she would have done negligently?
She may not have maintained a proper lookout because, quite frankly, the jury's entitled to disbelieve everything she says. And I think they disbelieved a lot of it on her damages. But there's any number of cases in this court.
Then what other evidence was there that she was?
Well, if my client stopped and proceeded out and he drives slow as molasses, according to his own testimony, and comes out from that distance and she still hits him, she should have seen something. And maybe she wasn't looking. I don't know. But
so what is the standard? What standard of care are you saying that somebody that is driving the speed limit, going down the highway, what is the standard?
The standard is that of a reasonable person, and it's set out in a number of cases, including the Carpenter case, including the Aborn case, where the court said anybody on a through highway controlled by stop signs still has a duty to use reasonable care under the circumstances if somebody pulls out.
But normally there's allegations of speeding or something of that nature.
But many of those cases, Your Honor, simply involve somebody coming out or not stopping or stopping and then pulling out. The Carpenter case is a good case. That case was the opposite. The plaintiff was the person pulling out as opposed to the person on the through road. But I think it's a fact question, especially when there's a significant difference of what the facts are.
You'd started to address the stipulation.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Freeman sent me that list saying this is a summary of her medical expenses, and I said, well, you're not entitled to recover the, I think he asked for the impairment rating, so he changed it. And there was no written stipulation of any kind that they're fair and reasonable. We never had any discussion, and there's nothing in the record that said you don't have to call anybody from the hospitals or anything to put this in. He put that in through her and asked her whether or not that's a recapitulation of her medical payments and expenses. Yes, he offered it. No objection. It's in. That's on page 35 of the transcript. That's the evidence.
Did you ever challenge the expenses as not fair and reasonable of the emergency room and the
We didn't challenge any of the expenses as fair and reasonable, but Your Honor, the plaintiff has the burden to prove that they're fair and reasonable and medically necessary. And as this court in Freeman versus Berg said, you know, jury didn't even have to award all of them, you know, because the plaintiff has a burden of proof on that issue. And, you know, I think it's a case where the verdict is explainable by the plaintiff failing to carry her burden of proof. She offered no proof on any of these issues, like proximate cause for those bills or reasonable and medically necessary. So if the plaintiff doesn't carry her burden of proof, the jury is justified. They can read the jury instructions, which says essentially that that's what she has to prove. And I think that's what they did. They followed the instructions. They did what the court told them to do. And now they're being criticized. And I don't think the court looked at the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict.
How do we know that? He doesn't say it anywhere what standard he used.
He said, he quoted specifically from Henry versus Henry to say that I don't have to look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party on a new trial motion.
He says that on the
He record. Says it in the transcript. And that might be true in a case where the jury's palpably mistaken as to the rule of law on damages, but I don't think that's the rule, and that's never been the rule that this court has applied in cases where there's issues or fact questions about causation and damages. And it's not the rule that the court applied in the Fechner case. It's not the rule that the court applied in the Bridges case. So for those reasons, I think the judge applied the wrong standard, and therefore I think he abused his discretion. He never even tried to reconcile the verdict with the evidence. He just agreed with Mr. Freeman and said, well, they should have at least awarded the ambulance and the ER costs. And that's all he said on it. Because I think, as he said, it must have been the result of some bias or passion or prejudice. But I think the verdict is explainable because there was no proof. And because it's explainable because of the absence of proof, I think this court should reverse and remand it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. Court will be in recess until 10 o'clock.